As you heard from Melissa Ingles in the WPR News this morning, Governor Evers signed a two-year, more than $87 billion state budget on Thursday that will begin later this month. It includes a more than $2 billion tax cut supported by Republicans. The governor used his veto pen to make 50 changes to the budget, though most of those were relatively minor. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent, and in no way does this appear to be a new era of bipartisanship, as the budget deal arrived along with the fairly standard partisan criticisms we've come to expect. So what questions do you have about Wisconsin's revenue and spending plans over these next 2 years? Would you like to speak on behalf of Republicans or Democrats this morning? And what do you think of Wisconsin's process for budgeting? 1-800-642-1234 to join us. You can always email us, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is Patrick Marley, state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Let's run down some of the highlights of the budget that was signed. Or let's start with the vetoes, actually. What didn't make it into the budget that the Republicans were calling for, Patrick?
You know, in the grand scheme of things, the vetoes were really minor this time. Governors in Wisconsin have pretty broad veto authority, but the governor didn't exercise it much. I mean, they're constrained by what's in the budget, right? They can only take things out. They can't really put things back in unless they get extremely creative. So, you know, the governor didn't like aspects of the budget, but there wasn't really much he could do with his veto pen to address those. So, you know, despite the 50 vetoes, it's really a large-scale acceptance of what the Republicans passed.
The governor didn't use his veto powers this time to increase funding for K through 12 schools. Is that part of the power of the veto pen as you see it, Patrick?
Absolutely. So the governor's veto powers are unusual in Wisconsin because they can strike out individual words. It's not just, you know, a full section, but individual words. So in 2019, the governor was able to find a way to sort of string together some phrases and words to get another $65 million for schools. Republicans learned from that and were more careful about the way they phrased things and, you know, what order they put words in the budget. So he didn't see a chance to do that. There was also a lawsuit over his previous vetoes, not the school one, but other vetoes that he passed. And the Supreme Court, which for decades has been very deferential to the governor's veto powers, hemmed him in a little bit. And so it was unclear exactly what the rules were for this budget, but it was clear that they were more strict than they'd been in the past. So I would say Evers did not really test the grounds on that as to how far that Supreme Court ruling limits him.
Patrick Marley, the governor also vetoed doubling how much money would be transferred to the state's tax-funded operating budget for transportation. Why did he veto that?
So the transportation fund is mostly funded with gas taxes and vehicle fees. And it's has had a transfer for some time of a small amount of the money that's paid with sales tax and income tax. And so Republicans wanted to increase that from 0.25% to half a percentage point and to have that go on permanently forevermore. The governor vetoed it so that would be a temporary change. We'd put in a little more money from sales tax and income tax for a short period of time. The rationale for that, he said, is that the transportation fund should be funded with fees specifically related to transportation and not having general taxes sort of help prop it up.
The governor vetoed sending $550 million to the state's rainy day fund, so the money remains available for spending on, well, in the general fund. Here is Governor Evers' comments after signing the budget with some criticism for Republicans.
They could have done the right thing. They still can do the right thing. There is money left in the state coffers that can be used for schools and other issues. So I'm very hopeful that they'll spend some time thinking through this instead of just going home and spending the rest of the summer enjoying themselves. There's work to be done.
The governor alluded to other ways for funding education in Wisconsin after signing the budget last week, didn't he, Patrick?
Yes. So the veto he did for the rainy day fund is really symbolic more than anything. He's preventing $550 million from getting into that fund, but it essentially, because there's no way to spend it, at least by the governor on his own, it sits in a different savings account. So the effect is the same on the state's bottom line. We just have money sitting in one account instead of another. It does give him a rhetorical advantage to make the case that we have this money sitting in our checking account, essentially, and that we could spend it. He wanted to spend far more on education than Republicans did. He wanted to spend more than $1 billion increased funding for K-12. The Republicans gave him about $128 million specifically that could be spent on education. And so, you know, I think you'll continue to see him as he runs for re-election say this money's sitting there. We should pass a bill right now. We could give schools even more money than we have.
Patrick Marley is a state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Taking your questions this morning, what do you think of Republicans and Democrats' proposals for state spending and fundraising? What are your top priorities? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation, where Jimmy from Valley Junction is standing by. Jimmy, you're on the air.
Morning. Yeah, I just heard on the news about a possible loan program to purchase some paper mills, and the Republicans wanted some money for that, but yet they're cutting taxes by $2 billion. So, you know, are they really serious about this loan thing, or is this just another political stunt to make Evers look bad, or similar to the Foxconn con that little Scotty and his buddy Trump pulled off right before the election?
Jimmy, I'm going to ask Patrick here about the mill bill and where that stands. Patrick?
So the how to deal with the closed mills in Wisconsin Rapids and Park Falls has become a little bit of a political hot potato. The governor had a bill that would have expanded Medicaid, and then that would have brought the state more federal money, used that to spend on a number of priorities that Republicans like, including taking care of that mill. Republicans didn't take up that bill because they've long opposed the expansion of Medicaid under Obamacare. And the Republicans then passed their own bill to do essentially the same thing, get those mills or give loans to get those mills. But that would have used federal COVID stimulus money. Evers on Thursday vetoed that bill because he says it's unclear that the state could use the COVID money for that. And, you know, if that were to happen, then the state would have to pick up those costs. So what you have is, you know, both parties say that they want to help those mills and find a way to get those jobs, but in total disagreement about how to do it. And the two parties very rarely talk. So it's hard to see at the moment how progress could be made there.
As far as the budget goes, there were some criticisms on both sides, and I wanted to hear State Representative Mark Bourne, who co-chairs the legislators' budget writing committee, as he responds to Governor Evers signing the budget last Thursday.
Personally, I find it laughable and hypocritical that just 6 months ago, when Governor Evers introduced his budget and they proposed an over $1 billion tax increase, he was given the opportunity to lead and propose tax cuts for the hardworking families of Wisconsin, and he failed.
Patrick, the Republican leadership in the legislature said just about the same thing in reaction to the state budget, calling it the most conservative budget in a generation.
They did call it that. Both Speaker Voss and the Senate Majority Leader Devin Leahy called it that, which is a pretty surprising thing given that, you know, for 8 years, Republicans controlled all the state government. They expanded school choice programs with the budget. They implemented parts of Act 10 with that. They put drug testing requirements in for some public benefits programs. So to call this budget the most conservative in a generation, it was a little bit of a surprise. The reason they're calling it that is because it's got this very large income tax cut, about $2 billion, more than $2 billion. And then it's also got a property tax cut of about $600 million. So the Republicans are happy that their version of the budget got through. They're bothered that Evers is now claiming credit for those tax cuts because he's the one who signed them. So I think you're going to hear a lot of political noise about who deserves the credit for those tax cuts.
Well, does this just set the scene for elections next year and how both parties are trying to carve out their niche and what they want to take credit for in this budget?
Absolutely. You'll see a lot of talk about this in that, you know, the governor made clear from the moment he signed the budget that he's going to be campaigning on this tax cut as part of the things that he's raising. He's done. It takes away whoever his Republican opponent may be. It takes away an issue for them. You know, had he vetoed that tax cut, you would have heard a lot about that from Republicans. Now the candidates for governor are going to have to find ways to criticize Evers, but they'll have difficulty criticizing the budget he signed because other Republicans are calling it the most conservative in a generation.
The Republican leadership in the state legislature. Patrick Marley is a state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And now we pivot to Lincoln Hills and what's next for our youth prisons with Copper Lake. Now that the deadlines for their closure have come and gone. The reporter who broke the story is our guest, and we will get the very latest from him next, as well as from you at 1-800-642-1234. You're listening to the State Capitol Report. I'm Lee Rayburn on The Morning Show, and this is the Ideas Network. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and it was back in the spring of 2018 when then-Governor Scott Walker signed into law a plan to close the Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake youth prisons by January of this year. The idea, in theory, was to keep incarcerated kids closer to their families. Then in 2019, Governor Evers moved that deadline back to July, and we're going to blow past that deadline. So this morning, we're joined by the reporter who helped bring this story to our attention years ago now, and he's still covering it for us today. What do you want to know about Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake? What do you think about the reported abuse at Lincoln Hills and what it's done to recidivism rates in Wisconsin? And how do you think we should treat kids who break the law? We'll hear from you this morning at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us ideas at WPR.org. Patrick Marley, state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, has been covering this. When did you start covering this story, Patrick?
Oh, let's see. Must have been about 2017 that we learned about a raid on Lincoln Hills by a large group of law enforcement. That's really what kicked off our coverage of the problems that had been happening there.
And although we've had deadlines for their closures and we've heard the justifications why, the closures have not happened. And now this Northwoods Youth Prison remains open with incarcerated juvenile inmates. Why didn't the closure happen?
Well, you can put the responsibility for not closing that entirely on the politicians in Madison. They passed this bill. I mean, there was unanimous support for the idea of closing Lincoln Hills and establishing new regional facilities where incarcerated kids would stay. That way they'd be closer to their homes. You could have these in, you know, the Milwaukee and Southeast Wisconsin region, Madison. The bill didn't stipulate where they would be, but there was this process set out to build these. It turned out to be more expensive than the initial bill provided funding for. They recognized that very quickly. And so then there's been this ongoing discussion about how we fund it, how much we should spend on it, where we build them, and everything is just stalled. And so they passed a bill. When Evers said that they hadn't provided him enough time and he needed another more time to close it, Republican legislators said 6 months was the maximum. They wouldn't give him any more time than that, so they extended it from January to July. But they gave no additional funding. And so all sides recognize that, you know, you can't close Lincoln Hills until you have these new facilities, but we haven't made any progress on that. Beyond, there has been some expansion of the Mendota Juvenile Mental Health Facility, and that will take some of the kids who are at Lincoln Hills, but we need these other facilities. If we're going to go along with what the original plan was, we would need new facilities, and, you know, shovels haven't been put in the ground, sites haven't even been selected yet.
And there was nothing in the signed budget that would give us any notice that things would change regarding our youth prisons in Wisconsin.
No, they didn't address this in the budget.
Let's go to Steve from Rice Lake now at 1-800-642-1234. Steve, good morning. You're on with Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Yeah, good morning. So I work inside the prison system, and I'm just wondering, was there any discussion about the staffing shortages security-wise? I mean, we've got 25% to 40% staffing shortages in some of these adult institutions, and that combined with the fact that they've maxed out the wages at a 15-year rate. You know, you've got people like myself who've got almost a decade more than that, and we're being paid at a 15-year rate. I mean, how do they expect to fix that kind of stuff? Have they addressed any of that? I'll take my answer off the air.
And before you answer, Patrick, we've got another caller here, similar story, and perhaps we could put them together. Paul in Eagle River. Good morning. You're on the air with Patrick Marley.
Yes, sir. Thanks for my call. So my wife was a guard at Lincoln Hills for almost 2 years. The staffing is really, really poor there because of the amount of injured staff. Right now there's 25 staff members out on injured leave because of inmates injuring staff, and that never sees daylight. And she was working 100 hours a week sometimes.
Wow. How long ago was this, Paul?
2 years ago.
What was it like when she would come home from work? Give us an idea of what that work did to work-life balance.
Well, she was forced to work double shifts. Absolutely forced. So if you plan, you cannot plan anything. She would get done with her 8-hour shift. 20 minutes before her 8-hour shift was done, they said, you got to work another 8. So most of the time she ended up staying at a hotel down near the prison because she had a 45-minute commute every day. So to drive home and sleep 4 or 5 hours and then drive right back to work, because she had a couple of weeks that were 104 hours a week. And then she was injured on the job. She was slammed against a wall, and she had bulged discs in her neck. And when Governor Evers took over, they took away pepper spray, and the guards cannot literally defend themselves against the youth in the prison. They cannot touch them or anything.
Paul from Eagle River, Steve from Rice Lake, appreciate what you have to share this morning at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Patrick, back-to-back stories of understaffing, which is part of what you have covered at this youth prison.
Yeah, this has been a long-running problem at all of the state's correctional facilities. We've put a lot into the problems at Lincoln Hills with their staffing. What both of these guys describe is in keeping with what we've heard from lots of other people. It is, you know, prisons, unlike maybe other workplaces, if you have someone call in sick, if you just don't have a job filled, you can't just leave a post vacant. In most cases, you have to have someone there. If they're facilities that have to be staffed 24/7. So this does happen where workers, they expect to be called into a second shift. When their first shift is over, they're immediately put onto a second shift, so they have to work 16 hours. It's not happening just at Lincoln Hills. It's at all the adult prisons as well. There was a provision in the budget to give, a $5 hourly increase to those who work at the prisons with the biggest staffing shortages. So they're hoping that that will help increase some of their the problem at the places that have the worst issues. But the fact is there are staffing shortages all over the prison system in the state.
Patrick Marley, state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, breaking the story about Lincoln Hills, going back to the raids of 2015, when at that time, according to the Department of Corrections, Patrick, Lincoln Hills held 264 inmates. Do you know what the population is there now?
We're a lot down from that. I don't have the most current figures, but we're less than 100. And that is because and you're right, you mentioned that this all started in 2015. I guess it goes back a little further than I recall. the numbers have come down a lot for a number of reasons. Judges are less inclined to send them there. Counties are finding other places to put these kids. They might be able to have them in a setting that falls short of what's effectively a prison. And so there have been efforts to divert the numbers, which makes the ultimate problem easier to solve, right? If you have to find new facilities for 80 kids rather than 260 kids, that makes it easier to do.
Sure, but do we have any indication when the soonest we would see Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake closed?
You can give no timeline whatsoever because they haven't appropriated enough money for it. So, maybe we'll see a bill later this session. But whether that will advance, completely unclear. It's been just stalled for a couple of years now, and no one's really taken the mantle to try to find a way to solve it.
As you've been covering this story of Lincoln Hills, Patrick Marley, what's on the horizon and what are you looking for next?
Well, I guess I would want to see if in the remaining part of this session anybody tries to come up with a way to address this. It obviously didn't make it into the budget. There weren't really discussions of it in the budget. Beyond the governor, when he initially proposed this, he wanted to address this. The Republican lawmakers took that out. So the question is, does anyone put it forward now this fall? And if so, can they get some momentum for it? Or do we get, you know, caught up in an election year where Republicans don't want to give a win to the governor and they hold back on this, or they hold back for some other reason? They think that it's too expensive, or they've, you know, rethought how they want to house incarcerated youth.
Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake is a political hot potato as we move towards the election. We shall keep an eye on that with our guest from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Patrick Marley. Thank you as always.
Thank you.
Up next is news. Then the State Capitol Report continues with State Representative Janelle Branchen from Menominee Falls. She chairs the Assembly's Committee on Elections and Campaigns and recently visited Arizona to review an audit of the 2020 elections. That's when we continue following the news. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.